to talk about me. Some of you may remember a pop or country music song where a guy sang, "I want to talk about me," instead of you, you, you. This morning I want to talk about me. I've been thinking about this idea of judgment. And the order of the day is, don't judge me. Don't judge me. We even go sometimes when we're talking about judgment to passages like Matthew 18. And I've been thinking about that. I'm not going to talk about that this morning. But I've been thinking about that a lot, and I think we will talk about that sometime in the near future. But it's time we flip the script on the overused and misused slogan of so many people today, don't judge me. Some jobs have work evaluations. In fact, I suppose many jobs do. Some of them are bi-yearly, some of them are yearly. Mine are kind of daily because I judge myself. And I want to know when I'm wrong about something. And I want to know about that in any area of my spiritual life. I don't really care what you think about whether I mow my grass often enough or not, or whether I wash the windows in the house often enough. My wife doesn't do that at all. She said when we got married, I don't wash windows, and she's lived up to her word. I don't really care about those kinds, but I care about spiritual things. I care about truth. I care about sin. And I want to know when I'm doing wrong. I do examine myself, and the scriptures instruct me to do that. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 4, for instance, it says there to us, let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. And I do judge myself. Galatians, 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 31 says, for if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. In other words, the idea is if we look at ourselves and examine ourselves, we will correct the things that we find. But the problem is I may be blind to what others can clearly see. So that doesn't mean because I examine myself and judge myself that I'm always right, or that I'm never doing anything wrong or saying the wrong things. Because others can see things that sometimes we cannot see ourselves, and sometimes we deceive ourselves. Some judgments, though, from others are completely subjective. Judgments result from just not knowing the details. You may think you know the details, and you may say something to me, and you may say, this is the way you should have done it, or this is what you should have done, or it was wrong for you to do it. This, you may not know, because you may not know the details. You may not know the facts. Others are objective because they're right or wrong scripturally. So you can look at the scriptures and say, this is right, or perchance, this is wrong. You should not have done this because this is a violation of scriptural things. So I want to talk about, you know, judging me, looking at me. And I want to talk about a little bit this morning the manner of judgment. Each one of us, and I'm no exception to that, want to be judged with righteous judgment. And I want to be judged the way that I hope that I'm willing to judge other people. And so let's talk about righteous judgment for a moment. And by that I mean not, you know, I want righteous judgment, not vengeful judgment. Vengeful judgment is, let's get even. Something was said or done that I didn't like or I didn't appreciate or may have made me feel bad. So I want to get even, and I'm going to try to find a way to get even with in judgment. Vengeful judgment. Its intent is to cause pain or embarrassment or something of that nature. And, you know, I'm not talking about, when I talk about righteous judgment, the kind of command fire to come down from heaven kind of judgment upon someone. Let me judge someone and bring, you know, extreme pain upon their head. You know, some of the disciples had that idea, didn't they? They early on, Jesus had to teach them a lesson In Luke chapter 9, and that'll be our example passage there, we find that Jesus, before his ascension, he goes through one of the cities of Samaria, and the Samaritans just flat out rejected him. He wasn't what they expected. He wasn't going to do what they expected him to do. And it made his disciples, some of his disciples, angry that they rejected Jesus. So let's look at that account. Luke 9, verse 51, beginning. It says, "Now it came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face. And as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive him, because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem." That wasn't his stopping place, in other words. And when his disciples James and John saw this, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just as Elijah did?" But he turned and rebuked them and said, "You do not know what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." And they went to another village. So we see here was a vengeful kind of judgment against those people. Let's just call fire down from heaven and punish them big time. Jesus said, you know, really, what in the end would have been the purpose in that judgment? In fact, wouldn't that have been kind of a final judgment to call fire down upon them? But final judgment belongs to the Lord. But I'll tell you what you can do. If you see something erroneous in me, you can help me get ready for the final judgment by making a temporal judgment now and by pointing out my sins. In other words, it's good for me to be judged if I'm involved in sin or error. So not vengeful judgment, but judgment that is intended to be helpful. And not too quickly. We sometimes are very quick to judge situations, aren't we? We'll see something out there and we'll make a snap judgment, and we may miss what's happening by a country mile. We just don't have the facts. We just don't know. So I don't want to be judged too hastily. Jesus warns this way. He says, not to judge according to appearance, but with righteous judgment. It takes time sometimes to have the proper judgment. You know what we do in our society? And I don't think any single one of you will disagree with me on this. We hear the news, we hear the happening, and we get the judgment all in one, and it just happened. There hadn't been possibly any time at all to gather the facts, to judge the situation, and to come to a good and proper conclusion about what's going on. And often the very first narrative will be the last narrative as well, because nothing will interfere with what they think they said and knew to start with. No facts. And we could give numerous illustrations. We just won't take the time to do that this morning. We judge too quickly. So this means we need to get to know the facts. What is true? And we might even have to admit that we don't know all the facts, and we don't know what all is true about a given situation. There may be extenuating or mitigating circumstances that you don't know about. And that's true in individual judgments as well. We just may not know. You know, I'm reminded, and I probably have shared this with you in the past, but I remember a number of years ago, a man that was preparing to give a sermon before a very large number of brethren, several hundred brethren. And he got up and he gave the lesson, and he kind of stumbled through some things, and he seemed like he just wasn't quite with it, but maybe wasn't very well prepared. Things looked, you know, it was painful for those listening and probably the one delivering. Okay, and people were talking about it. Well, he knew he was going to give this sermon months in advance. He should have had plenty of time to prepare, whatever it took to be ready. He should have been ready and all those things. And people would say, yes, that should be true. And then they found out that literally a minute or two before he was to deliver the lesson, he learned that a close relative, I can't remember if it was a father or a child, but someone very close to him had died suddenly. And that's what he heard just before he got up to speak. And now the judgment about his delivery of the lesson was completely different. When people heard that, oh, what a wonderful job he did under the very trying and mitigating circumstances he was in. And I don't know if I could have done it or done it as well as he did. And it was totally different. You know what the difference was? Knowledge, knowing the circumstances. So we need to always consider circumstances. But having said all that, it doesn't change this part of what I'm wanting to say. And that is, if we know the facts, and the facts point to my guilt, then I need to be loved enough to rebuke me. So, facts will not change sin. My illustration didn't include sin. But we can have sin, and knowing the facts, if it is sinful, it still needs to be corrected. We need to know that. You know, love is what motivated Jesus, if we think about that. In Revelation 3:19, Jesus said, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Now, if we go back to Hebrews 12, we'll find out the same, even though love is not used in Hebrews 12, the idea of discipline for the good and welfare of the one in error is certainly a strong motivation in Hebrews chapter 12. Jesus says, many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. And so let's think of that. Why do we correct other brethren? Well, if our motivation is vengeance, let's get even about something that they may have done, and well, we've got the wrong motivation. But if our motivation is love, because we want to restore the soul to God, that's the motivation we should have. For whoever it is. Okay. And because open rebuke is better than love concealed. Sometimes we have in our idea of correction is that we love someone too much to correct them. That's what the wise man here is addressing. No, we love them enough to correct them. We don't love them so much that we won't correct them. That's maybe another subject in another venue, but we see the point in that. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Proverbs 27:5. And faithful are the wounds of a friend. That he's not talking about throwing stones at someone. Beating him overhead, he's talking about when we are corrected. Do we always enjoy that? You know, the Hebrew writer says for the present time it is not joyous. And we think back to our childhood when one of our parents decided to use the rod of correction. Did we enjoy that? I just can't wait till today till I get spanked with a rod. We didn't do that. But if we're wise today, we see the value of that correction as we were growing up. Okay. Faithful are the wounds of the friend who tells us what we need to hear and not what we want to hear. Even though it may wound us temporarily, has done us a favor because they love us enough to do that. So faithful are the wounds of a friend. I was talking to a young man the other day that I've had quite a bit of opportunity to study with. And he asked me a difficult question about himself. And I answered it to the best of my ability from experience in Scripture. And as I was telling him, I'm thinking, he won't like this answer. And he didn't. But he liked the fact that I gave him the answer. And he told me, this is exactly what he told me. I called you because I knew you would tell me what I needed to hear and not necessarily what I want to hear. So he was saying, I called somebody that I thought would help me be guided where I needed to go. And I think probably as I was talking, it was a little bit wounful, a little bit hurtful for me to say those things. To say you need to look introspectively and not out at other people. You need to look at yourself. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. So, not too quickly, but give what is needed. And not hypocritically. We judge not hypocritically. What do I mean by that? Well, I would prefer when you're judging me not to judge me hypocritically. That you not be guilty of the same thing of which you accuse me. Now, the truth is I'm not in control of that. And I'm not even supposed to be in control of that. It's something that others looking at me have to look at themselves with. It's not up to me. But I prefer not to be that way. Now, let's go to Matthew. Somebody might have thought, since we're talking about this subject, we'd start with Matthew chapter 7. But we're not going to. And it's going to have some impact upon the lesson, but not a lot. But let's look at it. Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. We're familiar with verse 1, really familiar. Almost everybody has this memorized. Especially those who do not want to be judged. They memorize this passage. Judge not, that you be not judged. Now that's almost always the portion of this verse that I hear. I rarely hear the rest of the verse, which is, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use it, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and do not consider the plank that's in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye. Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Now, what's the application of this? Never talk to another about the wrong? No, that's not the application, but this is the application. Don't talk to others about their wrong without self-examination first. Make sure you're not doing the same thing. I mean, there's a lot of little parables that people use to make that point. When you're pointing the fingers of others, how many fingers you have pointing back at you. That kind of, and there's a legitimate application to that idea. But the idea is we need to be careful about our own lives before we judge other people's lives. We're not doing the same thing. There's another passage rarely used in this context, but it's a legitimate passage to use because we talk about Matthew 7, 1 through 5, Matthew 7, 1, and then we need to talk about the rest of the verses through verse 5. But Romans chapter 2 is another very similar passage. We might even call it a parallel passage in a sense. And it is, he says, therefore, Romans 2, verse 1, therefore you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge, for in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same things, but we know that the judgment of God is according to truth against those who practice such things. And do you think this, O man, you who judge those practicing such things and doing the same, that you will escape the judgment of God? In other words, if you judge a man for lying, and you're a liar, he says, you think you're going to escape the judgment of God? If you're a thief, you think you're going to escape the judgment of God? And just fill in the blank, whatever sin you want. He's saying, if you're doing the same thing, do you think you're going to escape God's judgment because you judge another? Now, why would I be concerned about hypocrisy if you're judging me? And by the way, that's not the time for me to say, well, huh, you're doing the same thing. Because that's one way we try to escape concluding that we need to deal with our own sin. So it's not for my sake, because your hypocrisy doesn't change my innocence or guilt. It doesn't change what I've done. If I'm guilty, I'm still guilty. But it's really, I mentioned, for your sake. Make sure, if you're the one doing the judging, that you humbly apply the same standard, which is the gospel, which is the scriptures, to yourself that apply to me. And both of us need to be willing to repent. So both these passages make that point for us. And then, in the spirit of meekness. In the spirit of meekness. Galatians 6 verse 1 makes that point, doesn't it? It's easier on me, and actually easier on you, if you come to me, at least initially, in the spirit of meekness. I noticed this. Maybe we ought to consider to talk about this. Maybe something needs our attention. It best served if we do that in private, at least initially. So in the spirit of meekness, and in that spirit, Galatians 6 verse 1, he says, considering thyself, lest you also be tempted. Consider yourself. I've always, and I hope I'm right about this, I think I'm right about this, but I've always taken that to mean, when I approach someone else about their sin, I need to consider myself and how I'm treating them, because tomorrow it may be me that they're talking to, and how do I want to be treated if they're talking to me? Now, circumstances may call for a sharper rebuke at some point. That may happen. I mean, you may approach someone in the spirit of gentleness, maybe even more than once, several times, and they don't listen. So maybe they need called out. That's what we say today. In Titus 1 verse 13, Paul says, speaking of the Christian, this testimony is true, therefore rebuke them sharply. In other words, they haven't listened, it's time to call them out, that they may be sound in the faith. So circumstances may call for a sharper rebuke. And then, if that's the case, then it's on me to respond. The onus becomes on me to respond with a broken and contrite heart. So there's a way to deliver the message and a way to receive the message as well. So the bottom line is, so to speak, be careful in your approach. But from my standpoint, how you speak to me does not change the facts. If I'm guilty of sin, that should be my biggest concern, not the manner in which you spoke to me. You know what I find sometimes among brethren? Well, he didn't say it to me the right way. I mean, I needed to hear it, but he didn't say it to me the way I wanted to hear it. And my wife and I was talking about this just a couple of days ago, about a circumstance that we knew about, and we've known similar circumstances over the years. Someone involved in sin, rebuked for their sin, corrected for their sin, And the focus of attention changes from the one involved in sin to the one who called them out for their sin. And they're the ones judged to be in sin and doing wrong because they didn't do it exactly the way somebody thought it should have been done. I don't understand that. I just tell you, I don't understand that. And I think I need to promote within myself the attitude that if I'm guilty of sin and I'm corrected of sin, then I need to be thankful for the person who approaches me about it to correct me so that I can be saved, so I won't be lost, and not be all that concerned about the way they approach me about it. Now, I've talked about that a lot this morning, but I don't think we should be all that concerned about it. We say, well, I really do need to correct them, but boy, they need to change their attitude. That's probably not going to get us very far, is it? So I want to talk for a moment or two then in the end about receiving judgment. How do I receive judgment? How do I receive rebuke? It could be that my actions call for a public rebuke, much like Peter received at the hands of Paul in Galatians chapter 2. In Galatians chapter 2, verse 13, it says, "And the rest of the Jews also played the hypocrite with him, so that even Barnabas was carried away with their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, 'If you, being a Jew, live in the manner of Gentiles and not as the Jews, why do you compel the Jews to live, the Gentiles to live as the Jews?'" This is a public calling out of Peter. He's an apostle. He was wrong about something, and he had influenced other people to be wrong about the same subject. If we read through Acts, how much opportunity had Peter had to correct this thinking that he had about the Judaizing teachers? How much opportunity? He had a lot, hadn't he? Well, we've got chapters devoted to their discovering, knowing and sharing, I shouldn't say discovering, knowing and sharing the truth about this very subject. And yet, he was carried away into this this false idea. I want to be quick to say, it doesn't say Peter taught it, but he compromised with it. And that was an issue. That was a problem. Okay. And so he was called out. Not only did that happen to him in a public way in the first century, we're talking about today, almost 2,000 years later, here he is used as an example of this type of situation. And although I have no intention to do so, if I teach a false doctrine, I shouldn't be surprised when you feel the need to warn other people about me. I've found people that are called out for their false doctrine and often act like they're just wounded beyond recognition because how dare people call them out publicly. You should have called me out privately. Peter's Paul called out publicly here. Because why? Because what he did was in a public way. Public teaching invites public scrutiny, and if necessary, it's public rebuke. And I understand that. And I also understand that if I listened to correction along the way, Peter would have listened to correction before it got to that point, it wouldn't have come to the point of public calling out. In other words, he had opportunity beforehand. And I should too if others are helping me see error. So, two things we want to conclude our lesson with this morning. The first one is, what is the don't judge me approach? Don't judge me approach. Here's what God says about that approach. He actually addresses it. In Proverbs 10, verse 17, we find there, "He who refuses correction goes astray." Now, the first part of that passage is, "He who keeps instructions is in the way of life, but he who refuses correction goes astray." And 12 and verse 1, "Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid." That's pretty plain, isn't it? The one who hates correction is stupid. Do you ever meet the person, have you ever talked to the person that says, here's what I know. Here's what I'm going to do. I don't want to hear anything from you in the way of correction or advice. You ever met that kind of person? Yeah. And people aren't sitting around saying, "Boy, what a wise person. They already have all the wisdom they need." You know what they're saying about that person? That person's stupid. Yeah. They may have been training their children not to use that word, so they may use another word, but they may say, "That person's foolish." Okay. By the way, I'm not calling out the Holy Spirit here on using the word stupid. He said, "But he who hates correction is stupid. Correction is helpful to us. Proverbs 15 verse 10. Harsh discipline is for him who forsakes the way, and he who hates correction will die. The ultimate end will be destruction for the person who hates correction. Verse 32, but he who disdains instruction despises his own soul. It's like say, he hates himself. He hates himself. But he who heeds rebuke gets understanding. So the don't judge me approach is foolish. It's stupid. It's eternally everlasting. Correction to the person who says, don't judge me, has the wrong approach to start with. And it will not, they will not be helped. Of course, there's the other side that we've been talking about, that is the please judge me approach. God talks about that approach as well. And in Proverbs 13 verse 18, he says, poverty and shame will come to him who disdains correction, but he who regards a rebuke will be honored. I see that. I needed that. Let me correct that. And people will say, here's a wise person who will be corrected. In 15 and verse 5, a fool despises his father's instructions, but he who receives correction is prudent. That's another word for wise. He who receives correction is wise. And then in verse 31 says, the ear that hears the rebuke of life will abide among the wise. And he who disdains instruction despises his own soul, but he who heeds rebuke gets understanding. That's two different approaches. And here's my question. Which is the better, more beneficial approach? Which will work better? Which one is the soul-saving approach to correction? And that's the way I need to be. And I've talked about me this morning. And you can do with the rest of it whatever you want to do with it. But you need to judge which is the better way. And the next time you hear that phrase, don't judge me, try to think about this lesson. Thank you for listening.